of a mutually beneficial negotiation, we are prepared to.
Abbas Araghchi stressed the U.S. must acknowledge Iran's right to peaceful nuclear energy under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. He noted negotiation is different from dictation, and for the time being, Iran is not convinced that the American side is ready for real serious talks. Araghchi stated the core sticking point is Washington's reluctance to acknowledge Tehran's right to peaceful nuclear technology, including uranium enrichment under the NPT. He also referred to U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran's nuclear sites in June. He called the attacks perhaps biggest violation of international law ever committed against a safeguarded nuclear facility under the monitoring of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Araghchi noted that Iran's nuclear facilities and surrounding areas may now be contaminated with radioactive material, blocking the resumption of inspections by the IAEA. Iran's ambassador to Tunis has handed over an official invitation letter from Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi to his Tunisian counterpart. It comes as the two countries seek to expand bilateral ties and diplomatic relations. Iskandar Naour reports.
Iran is stepping up its diplomatic efforts in Tunisia. The Iranian ambassador, Mir Masoud Husseinian, delivered a formal invitation from Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi following several high-level meetings, including talks with Tunisia's president and the foreign ministers of both nations. The letter invites Tunisian officials to visit Iran to exchange expertise and strengthen bilateral ties.
This invitation aims to enhance cooperation in political, cultural, and economic fields, building on the successful meetings our officials have had so far.
Iran's ambassador referred to the Tunisian president's previous meetings with Iran's foreign minister, describing them as a highly successful, noting that the discussions addressed key issues of mutual interest and were met with a positive reception.
President Kais Saied is well versed in Iranian laws, rights and culture, with knowledge spanning hundreds of years. He had previously met with the Iranian foreign minister, during which he demonstrated his understanding of issues important to the Iranian people. The meeting was very successful, and all matters were positively received.
Analysts say this rapprochement is strategic, reflecting Iran's growing regional influence and Tunisia's interest in strengthening ties with Tehran.
This rapprochement is no coincidence. It stems from Iran's rise as a regional power and Tunisia's willingness to engage on shared political, economic, and social issues, including support for Palestine.
Experts also emphasize that the diplomatic engagement is grounded in shared stances on regional conflicts and international politics.
On the political and international level, especially regarding the Palestinian cause and resistance against Israel, these shared principles guide the growing Tunisia-Iran relations.
Cultural exchange, joint expertise programs, and increased dialogue signal a new phase in bilateral relations. Both countries appear determined to build closer ties amid shifting regional dynamics. Iran is stepping up its outreach to Tunis, delivering a formal message from Foreign Minister Araghchi as both countries move closer diplomatically. The letter marks a new phase in their growing political alignment. Iskandar Naour, Tunis.
Israeli forces continue to violate a ceasefire with Hamas in the Gaza Strip, killing and injuring more civilians. Yeah, according to Palestinian sources, nearly 10 civilians were killed Saturday, including two in Beit Lahia and two in Al-Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. Fatalities in Al-Zaytun include a Palestinian woman and her son, who lost their lives after being hit with Israeli live fire. And a Palestinian man was also killed by Israeli drone strikes in Jabalia of northern Gaza. And the overall death toll from U.S. Israeli genocide since October of 2023 now exceeds 70,350 Palestinians killed and over 171,000 injured. And since the Gaza ceasefire took effect on October 10th of last month, nearly 370 civilians have been killed in the regime's violations. According to local sources, Israeli forces also demolished several buildings and structures in the Al-Shajjah neighborhood east of Gaza City. And suffering of Palestinian patients diagnosed with glaucoma has been exacerbated as a result of Israel's genocidal policy. Patients were not allowed to leave Gaza as the Rafah crossing was closed. And our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musaba reports from Deir Bala.
As the Israeli regime continues to violate the ceasefire deal, more repercussions continue to unfold for Palestinians amid an already catastrophic humanitarian situation. The Gaza Health Ministry announced that more than 4,000 Palestinian patients diagnosed with glaucoma disease are prevented from leaving the Gaza Strip. Those patients are in immense need to travel abroad to get the medical treatment. Otherwise, they are at risk of losing their sight.
My daughter was born with the glaucoma. Since her birth, we have been grappling with several obstacles. She underwent an urgent surgery in her eyes as a last choice. Now she is in a dire need to travel abroad for treatment to avoid any possible deterioration.
Glaucoma is an eye condition that damages the optic nerve. This damage can lead to vision loss or blindness. Damage to the optic nerve is often related to high pressure in the eye. According to doctors, those patients need to travel as soon as possible to avoid further deterioration in their health conditions.
We have at least 4,000 patients suffering from glaucoma. Undoubtedly, their suffering has been exacerbated by many factors. The first one is the lack of essential medications as a result of preventing those supplies from entering Gaza by Israel.
The glaucoma patients joined the list of more than 18,000 patients trapped in Gaza with no permits to leave, and they still face life-threatening consequences. The suffering of the Palestinian patients continues to worsen as the Israeli regime remains adamant in violating the ceasefire deal. According to Gazans, the truce mediators must take responsibilities and stop those violations. Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
Israeli forces have killed two young Palestinians in the occupied West Bank after they carried out resistance operation against regime forces. According to Israeli media, shooting took place in Baba Zawiya area of Al-Khalil. They said one soldier was wounded. The details of his injuries remains unclear at this exact point in time. But witnesses said the two Palestinians were killed instantly as Israeli forces fired directly at their vehicle that they were riding in. The regime forces then prevented ambulance crews from reaching the scene. They sealed off the area and abducted the bodies of the slain young Palestinians. Incidents, the latest in a series of violent Israeli incursions, which have left many Palestinians dead and led to the abduction of many others across the occupied territory. And now Hamas has hailed the operation as a natural response to the regime's ongoing aggression and daily crimes against the Palestinian people and their holy sites. And joining us earlier was our West Bank correspondent Naka Hamed with your details.
Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli forces after shooting directly towards them in the area of Bab al-Zawiya. The Palestinian martyrs are Ziad Naim Abu Dawood and Ahmed Khalil al-Rajabi. Palestinian eyewitnesses are saying that this was an execution operation. The Israeli forces shot live ammunition shooting those two Palestinians. Among them is Ziad Naim Abu Dawood, which is a worker in Al-Khalil municipality. He is a health worker in Al-Khalil municipality, and he was cleaning the streets. And when the Israeli forces fired live ammunition against the car which Ahmed Khalil al-Rajabi was in, he was immediately killed. There are more than 600 Palestinians that has been detained by the Israeli forces, and their families are trying their best to have them buried under in the Palestinian soil.
Thousands of the demonstrators held another weekly protest in occupied territories to condemn Israeli Prime Minister's policy on Gaza. They're also demanding an independent committee be established to investigate regime security failures of October 2023.
What we're doing tonight is protesting against the current actions of the government, mainly not to the decision not to have an investigation committee to investigate the aftermath of October 7th.
The military have already started investigating themselves, but the political rank does not. They want to investigate through a politicized committee. Basically, what it means is they want to appoint the people who will investigate them, and we will not have them. We will not have it.
In Tel Aviv, demonstrators voice anger over what they describe as Benjamin Netanyahu's attempt to avoid accountability for October 7th. Protesters have accused him of seeking to handpick members of the proposed investigation committee, a move they say will politicize the process and shield officials from any kind of real responsibility. And in addition to demands for an independent inquiry, many in the crowd also criticized regime's refusal to require military service for ultra-Orthodox men, calling it another example of unequal treatment in Israeli society. And meanwhile, organizers stressed they will continue the rally until a transparent and impartial probe is guaranteed to them. A decision by FIFA to grant it a new peace prize to the U.S. President Donald Trump has sparked immediate backlash. Critics say the move is in violation of the sporting body's supposed commitment to political neutrality. They also highlighted FIFA's hypocrisy in its refusal to ban Israel from world football over its Gaza genocide.
Players frequently face fines and bans from FIFA for expressing political messages, as the football governing body has long championed a policy of political neutrality. Yet on Friday, FIFA President Gianni Infantino awarded the inaugural FIFA Peace Prize to U.S. President Donald Trump. While presenting the prize, Infantino expressed support for Trump's international deals, including the so-called Abraham Accords that established formal ties between Israel and several Arab states without resolving the question of Palestinian statehood. Infantino has previously warned against using football to stoke division, saying that the political neutrality of sports should be protected. 2 years later, critics point out that he created a prize to celebrate peace and unity and then handed it to a president who called people from Somalia garbage just days prior and has advocated for increased military spending across the Western world. Trump also ordered the bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities in June and continues to arm Israel despite the ongoing genocide against Palestinians. Trump's administration has also carried out airstrikes against vessels near Venezuela. At home, the U.S. president has intensified an anti-immigration crackdown that has led to the detention and attempted deportation of non-citizens. Some advocates have been targeted for their criticism of Israel. A group of international activists who campaigned for suspending Israel from the world football have released a statement calling the award to Trump a shameful development. They also accused FIFA and UEFA of double standards over their failure to act against Israel in the 2 years of its war on Gaza, while swiftly sanctioning Russia following the breakout of the war in Ukraine in 2022. Infantino has refused to take action against Israel, arguing that football cannot solve geopolitical issues. The apparent preferential treatment of Israel calls into question the integrity of FIFA's supposed commitment to political neutrality, as FIFA continues to tout football as a unifying force on the global stage. It must now confront mounting accusations of hypocrisy and double standards that threaten its credibility.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
From east to west, throughout the vast vast land of Iran. You're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Iran, a place whose story is far more complex than the headlines suggest. Over the past four decades, the country has quietly engineered one of the most dramatic transformations in public health anywhere in the world. In 1979, life expectancy in Iran was just 56 years. Today, it stands at 75, a 19-year leap. For comparison, during the same period, life expectancy in the United States rose only 3 years, and in France, 8. The numbers tell a story of rapid, determined progress, built on investment in healthcare, expanded insurance coverage, and a national push for better medical services. It's an undeniable sign of Iran's progress and capabilities in the medical field. One of the clearest indicators of a nation's health is maternal and infant mortality. Following the victory of the Islamic Revolution, as access to clinics and trained medical staff increased, Iran saw maternal deaths fall to 20 per 100,000 live births. That's less than 1% of the global rate, which stands at roughly 200 per 100,000. Specialists in obstetrics and gynecology call it one of the country's quiet medical revolutions.
Still, some critics abroad often claim that Iran is a country that is defined only by its drones and missiles. But a deeper look inside the country's scientific institutions paints a very different picture.
Mr. Mohammad Reza Kompani, CEO of a high-tech medical equipment company, outlined how Iran's medical equipment sector has expanded since the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
The medical equipment of Iran has actually been started from the revolution, after the revolution. Before that, we had only the furnitures and such things and autoclave for sterilization of the goods. But after that, about 10 years after the revolution, right after the ending the war, the medical equipment started the industry in Iran. And now, which I'm here, we have about 85% of the items are required to be used in the hospitals. I'm talking about the devices, because in medical equipment, we have two parts, the devices and the sundries and the disposables we used in the hospitals. So in the medical equipment, the devices, 85% of the hospitals are doing the equipping by the Ministry of Health are provided from the local manufacturers. It's the, as you see here, it's the operation room, the ICU, CCU, the dialysis section, the emergency, and the general hospital.
Iran's global ranking in science and research has climbed to 15th. 65 Iranian universities are now counted among the world's top institutions, 22 of them in medical sciences. Many cancers once considered fatal in Iran are now routinely treatable. 97% of the medicines Iranians use are produced inside the country. And through advanced transplants from cord blood to bone marrow, Iranian physicians now treat more than 70 diseases that once required travel abroad. In an interview with us, Iranian scientist Sepideh Mirzayi Varzaghani, a Mustafa Prize laureate for scientists under 40 and a leading researcher in cancer drug resistance, highlighted Iran's giant leap in advanced therapeutic technologies, particularly in the field of gene therapy.
با دانشی که داریم و اینکه در حوزه زیست پزشکی ما امروز در دنیا حرف برای گفتن داریم و
With the expertise we have today, Iran has a real voice in the global biomedical arena. We've made significant progress in advanced therapeutic technologies, especially gene therapy. If there is sustained targeted investment, Iran can definitely become a regional hub for cancer research and cancer treatment.
Four decades ago, Iran ranked 39th in global scientific output. Today, it's 18th. In medical sciences alone, Iran has climbed from 38th to 10th worldwide. The country is among the five global leaders in advanced stem cell science, second in the world in bone marrow transplantation, and among the top 10 nations in nanotechnology, biotechnology, and infertility treatment. In biotechnology, Iran is now one of only three nations producing a wide portfolio of high-tech biopharmaceuticals, including the hepatitis B vaccine, erythropoietin, multiple interferons, streptokinase, GCSF, and others. And for more than 20 years, Iran has practiced clinical cell therapy, an area where many countries remain stuck in the research stage. Stem cells are now used in corneal, cardiac, skin, and other transplants across Iranian hospitals. Ms. Mirzayi also explained how her research on drug resistance in cancer led to her receiving the Mostafa Prize. The Mostafa Prize, founded in 2012, is considered one of the most prestigious science and technology awards in the Islamic world.
Can you please tell us more about your research that resulted in you receiving the Young Scientist Mostafa Prize?
پژوهش‌هایی که من انجام دادم و در واقع منجر شد به دریافت این جایزه ارزشمند.
My research, which led to this valuable award, focuses on drug resistance in cancer. I study the role of intercellular signaling pathways that cause cancer cells to become resistant to chemotherapy. These molecular pathways inside the cell play a crucial role. After several treatment cycles, they can make the patient's body less responsive to anti-cancer drugs and reduce the sensitivity of cancer cells therapy. What we're trying to do is to identify and regulate these signaling pathways. Cancer cells can activate certain pathways that, in turn, lower their sensitivity to treatment. By mapping and modulating these pathways, we aim to reduce drug resistance and restore or even increase the responsiveness of cancer cells to anti-cancer drugs.
Education has played a major part in this transformation. Iran now has nearly 70 medical universities and faculties, staffed by 22,000 faculty members.
The country's medical system hosts about 270,000 domestic students and 7,000 international students. Researchers in these institutions have authored more than 60,000 conference papers, 81,000 journal articles, and over 258,000 papers published internationally. 25 Iranian medical universities have been included in the Leiden Ranking 2025, with Tehran, Shahid Beheshti, Tabriz, Shiraz, and Iran University of Medical Sciences ranking below 500 globally. Women's enrollment in universities has also increased, and women now make up 50% of students and faculty, an important accomplishment. Many of these graduates have achieved prominent national and international positions.
Iran's push for scientific independence shows up in its pharmaceutical sector as well. For instance, 99% of medications are produced domestically.
Iran also produces 40% of its medical equipment and requires no outside technical assistance for the development of pharmaceutical formulations, something the country demonstrated during the Iran-Iraq War, the COVID-19 pandemic, and other crises. From 35 dependency-heavy drug companies in 1979, Iran has grown to more than 200 domestic pharmaceutical manufacturers today. Mr. Kompany also described how Iran weathered the COVID-19 pandemic using medical equipment supplied by domestic knowledge-based companies.
I'm telling you that For the rest of the products and the items which we have not produced yet, many, many science-based companies, which among of the 400 are working on them, and I will promise you in about 2 or 3 next year, we will have them as well. So there is no worry about the medical equipment, as we didn't have any problem during the corona. You see, in corona, we actually expend 6,000 ICU beds for the corona patients. So this means that we had the knowledge, we had the technology, we had the units, and all of them prevent us to choose the patients from the age and etc. to take it to the ICU. So every patient which needed to go to ICU, freely they could go. Then they hadn't had any problem. So Corona was the one among the 10 to 15 countries in the world which has no problem. Iran was one of them.
Iran now ranks first in Asia in the production of recombinant medicines, drugs used to treat cancers, MS, hemophilia, and viral illnesses. Vaccination coverage for children under 5 has risen from 20% before 1979 to full nationwide coverage, even in remote villages. Iran has produced key pharmaceutical raw materials for treatments of pulmonary hypertension, coagulation disorders, and chemotherapy. It has introduced the first nanotechnology-based injectable anti-cancer drug, Sinadoxazom, among a long list of other high-tech drugs. Iran is now one of the world's top 3 producers of radiopharmaceuticals, about 70 varieties. These supply 230 treatment centers and 6,500 nuclear medicine units inside Iran and are exported to 15 countries, generating roughly $17 million annually. The only remaining imports are certain raw isotopes, mainly from Russia. Ms. Mirzai also explained how combination therapies can ultimately help increase hope and survival prospects for cancer patients.
What are some of the practical and clinical applications of your research regarding the diagnosis or treatment of cancer in the near future?
اینها جزء درمان‌های در واقع درمان‌هایی که ترکیبی هستن و طراحی داروهایی که
These are part of what we call combination therapies and gene-based drug designs. Treatments that combine conventional anti-cancer drugs with genetic components. They can be highly effective in preventing and overcoming drug resistance, which is one of the biggest challenges in cancer treatment. We also focus on targeting personalized therapies so that one standard drug is not prescribed for all patients. Instead, treatment is tailored to each patient's genetic profile, because even 2 people with, for example, lung cancer can have very different patterns of drug resistance. Designing targeted drugs for each individual can significantly improve treatment outcomes, reduce overall costs, and most importantly, increase hope for patients living with cancer.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. Tehran Times: over 1,140 Iranians among world's 1% most cited researchers. A total of 1,142 Iranian researchers have been recognized among the world's top 1% most cited researchers in 2025, compared to 1,056 identified researchers in 2024, according to the Islamic World Science Citation Institute. The Ministry of Health, Treatment and Medical Education accounts for 52.77%, and the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology, with 427 researchers, represents 37.43% of the most cited Iranian researchers, ISCIIR reported. Clinical medicine with 446 entries, engineering with 209 entries, pharmacology and toxicology with 163 entries, chemistry with 140 entries, neuroscience and behavior with 115 entries, agriculture sciences with 100 entries, and social sciences with 77 entries held the highest shares of the most cited researchers. Three Iranian researchers have been among the highly cited award recipients. IRNA, Iran among top 20 countries in medical science output, ISC. Iran ranks among the top 20 countries in terms of medical science publications, indexed in the Scopus and Web of Science databases in 2023, according to figures from the Islamic World Science Citation Center. Given the importance of the health and medical fields and the advancements made by Iran in these areas, the ISC has prepared a report on the scientific and technological outputs in this sector, as well as on the most cited researchers and the global rankings of Iranian medical universities, ISC head Ahmad Fazilzadeh said on Saturday. Fazilzadeh pointed out that in comparison of different subject areas and the Web of Science databases, Iranian medical and health researchers have 158,678 documents in their names and the second highest scientific output from the country after engineering, technology, and natural sciences. ISNA, Iran among top three in radiopharmaceuticals expands nuclear scanners nationwide. Iran has established its position as one of the world's top three producers of radiopharmaceuticals, with statistics showing a nationwide increase in nuclear medicine imaging systems across all 31 provinces, according to reports. Radiopharmaceuticals technology, one of the major achievements of modern medicine, has driven significant advancements in diagnosing and treating complex diseases such as cancer over recent decades. Currently, Iran produces 70 types of radiopharmaceuticals, meeting the needs of more than 6,500 nuclear medicine centers nationwide. The country also exports these products to 15 countries, generating around $70 million in revenue in 2025. As part of efforts to achieve self-sufficiency, a cyclotron has been installed and commissioned at a hospital in Tehran to produce radioisotopes used in PET imaging. Mehr, Iran ranks 17th in world in science production, minister. Iran's Minister of Science, Research and Technology, Hossein Simoisarov, says that Iran is ranked 17th in the world in terms of production of the scientific articles. He made the remarks on the sidelines of the cabinet session on November 12th, where he emphasized that the country is at the 17th rank in the world in the field of science production. The minister promised that his ministry would take effective steps to promote the level of science production on the regional and international stage. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative.
Medical tourism has become another thriving industry. In 2024, nearly a million patients from 160 countries traveled to Iran for treatments ranging from infertility and cosmetic surgery to cardiac care, ophthalmology, and organ transplantation. Diako Abbasi, Secretary of the Health Tourism Council, explained how Iran has become a destination for health tourism.
Over the past two decades, Iran has become one of the leading health tourism destinations in the region and even the world. This growth stems from our scientific and technological progress in medicine, the strong expertise of Iranian doctors in diverse specialities, Iran's strategic location near countries with serious healthcare challenges, and our shared cultural background and long medical tradition. All of this has helped make Iran a distinctive and attractive destination for health tourism.
The country also maintains one of the region's largest research networks, with 849 medical research centers. These laboratories fuel Iran's growing scientific partnerships abroad and boost its presence in global health diplomacy.
We currently have around 300 hospitals licensed to provide international health services, fully capable of admitting foreign patients at a professional level. Their staff receive cross-cultural training, and they have dedicated international patient departments that operate under official authorization. In addition, there are about 700 active health tourism offices and companies that handle medical visas as well as patients' accommodation, transfers, and specialized guidance during their stay.
In ophthalmology, Iranian hospitals offer services on par with the most advanced nations. The country no longer sends patients abroad for eye care. Instead, patients from neighboring countries come to Iran for surgery due to lower costs, modern equipment, and highly trained surgeons.
Last year, our medical centers admitted foreign patients from around 140 countries, which shows just how strong and promising Iran's health tourism market is. Most international patients come from cardiology and cardiovascular surgery, orthopedics, infertility treatment, transplants, ophthalmology, and ENT procedures such as cochlear implants, as well as cosmetic and general surgeries. They travel from countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, the Persian Gulf states, even Saudi Arabia, as well as European countries such as the UK and Germany. We've also received patients from countries like India and even from the United States and Australia. Our data clearly show that Iran is now treating patients from across the world.
Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, more than 11,000 Iranians were sent abroad each year for medical care. Today, the flow has reversed. The country has performed over 50,000 kidney transplants, around 7,000 heart transplants, and 225 pediatric heart transplants. Every month, roughly 80 million medical services are delivered across the country. In recent years, Iran has also joined the list of medical equipment exporters. Officials announced at the Iran Health 2025 exhibition that Iranian-made medical technology is now shipped to more than 60 countries. More than 17,000 medical technologies have been registered inside Iran, and many are already on the global market. From vital sign monitors and defibrillators to dental and laboratory equipment, as well as precision surgical tools. Mr. Kompany also elaborated on the export of Iranian medical equipment products.
As we are meeting all the standards, international standards of the medical equipment for our product, as the MOH has based on that. So we now have a very good quality devices and also the disposables in the country. So we have no problem for that, and we are exporting about to 40 countries, and we are earning a lot of money among this exporting. And also, we have our, for the devices, we have our own production line in different countries. And by doing the rebranding, by the cooperation of the local agents and our companies in Iran, we have about in countries like Indonesia, Turkey, Iraq, Sweden.
About 65% of Iran's medical device industry is powered by knowledge-based companies, many of which born in universities and science parks. This pipeline of engineers and researchers has allowed Iran to develop high-tech devices such as AI-enhanced MRI machines, portable imaging units, and remote patient monitoring systems.
And there we have the Iranian ICU, which we have the ventilator, the special beds, the patient care monitoring system, and the gas supply. And as I told you during the corona, all this set was equipped from the local manufacturer, so we didn't have problem. And the price was very attractive because at the corona, many countries has to pay 10 times, 8 times of the real price of the ventilator. But here, this unit was given to the MOH for 7,000 euro. But we had many offers from other companies like 50,000, 70,000, 40,000, different prices, but 6,000 of this unit was bought for only at the price of the 7,000 euro, which was very good. And now the real price in the world is about 10 to 12,000 euro.
Exports of medical equipment surpassed $500 million in 2024 and are projected to reach about $650 million by the end of 2025. West Asian and African countries are the largest buyers. The appeal: Iranian devices typically cost 30 to 40% less than their European counterparts, but offer comparable precision and reliability.
The quality is very good, because they are meeting all these standards, international standards, and of course the price. For example, this operation room, the general operation room you see here, if you want to buy from a top brand company, European or American, you have to pay at least $200,000 to $300,000. But here you can get it for $70,000. So you see the different price.
And is it the same quality? So
it is.
You get the same quality, but for a lower price.
Of course. This is our advantage to enter into the market in international markets. So by having the people outside to cooperate with us, we will very soon will be anywhere in the world for the manufacturing of medical equipment and rebranding it.
Years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's healthcare system continues to grow. Through decades of expansion, from hospitals and clinics in major cities to health centers in the most remote villages, the promise of equitable healthcare has been largely realized. And for millions of people across the country, that promise has become a lived reality. That's all for today. Until next time, take care.
Fear in my heart, got nothing left to lose. I saw my loved ones die. Oh, I swear that I won't give in. By God, you'll never win. I'll fight for what's right. Nothing can stand in my way. Even if I get knocked down, I will stand my
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We're going to talk about some of the jurisprudential, topics of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me begin this episode with this question, Sheikh, if you don't mind. What is the duty of a woman whose husband's income is gained through Islamically illicit and impermissible means? Does she need to get a divorce?
Well, divorce is not necessary. It is not advisable. It's not a solution to the problem. So she must never contemplate a divorce, right? So long as she is not certain that the particular money for or property she is using is illegitimate,
mm-hmm.
and gained illicitly by her husband, she is allowed to make use of that thing, whatever she is given. And of course, it's very difficult to be certain, 100% sure that the money given to the wife is haram. Maybe her husband is doing some haram or halal work, or maybe halal and haram work, both of them.
Yes.
So how does she know that the money given to her is haram? It's also not necessary for her to investigate to understand,
yes,
that the money given to her is haram or halal. Okay. She must rest assured that the money she is given is halal. Okay. Mm-hmm. And of course, she, when it comes to one's being certain, okay, she is obligated to refrain from using or benefiting from the money or property she is certain.
Yes.
If she is 100% sure that the money, mm-hmm, is given to her is haram, it is necessary for her to avoid using or benefiting from that money.
Yes. Okay. Well, is it permissible to play frame drums, otherwise known as dafs,
okay,
at women-only gatherings? Let's say, for example, gatherings held for celebrating some feasts and festivals and festive religious ceremonies and weddings and religious services?
Well, there is a kind of controversy among scholars because of the narrations that have been passed on to the scholars. And there are various reports indicating that daf might be allowed, because in the past, for example, it's claimed, okay, that daf was played by some people in weddings and only by ladies in women-only gatherings. But when it comes to Ayatollah Khamenei's position, he is of the view that playing dafs,
yes,
in a way that causes one to be distanced from God, from Allah, and from spiritual and moral virtues, and to be drawn to sin and degradation is not allowed. Okay, and usually it tends to cause people to fall into some kind of sins.
Yes,
to be degraded. And not to mention the fact that it is not appropriate to play musical instruments on religious occasions and for celebrating the lives of the Prophet and his holy Ahl al-Bayt, even if the music is in line with canonic guidelines or the Sharia guidelines and can be deemed permissible.
Yes,
it is basically not appropriate, to be honest. Yes. And playing music is inconsistent with the sanctity and the holiness of their position, mm-hmm, and their status and, yes, their personages.
I see.
That's what the scholars have said, and not to mention also that even the custom of believers, the urf of the believers, do not accept such a thing.
Mm.
Playing music to celebrate the, for example, the birthdays of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and also the Imams.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Shabid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature. With Sheikh Javid, of course, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, you know, sometimes it happens that some people gain illicit money somewhere, and yes, they gather and collect an amount of wealth, but a part of their conscience, in fact, you know, feels guilty, and then they think that as a way of compensation, they can find a Sayyid and pay a part or a charity from the same illicit money gained to, just as I said, to make up for, you know, their illicit money, basically. So is it permissible actually to offer this charity to a needy Sayyid this way?
Right. Of course, the answer is yes. Okay, it is permissible to offer this amount of money, which people generally term it as Radd Mazalim.
Yes.
Right? And people, okay, Shia Muslims know what Radd Mazalim means. It's a compound word used, it can be translated as charity, intended as compensation for wealth that one has illicitly appropriated or gained from any rightful owner. So if, for example, a person knows the owner the owner from whom the money was illicitly obtained, it's necessary to return the money, right? But when the owner is not known and it's not possible to identify the owner, and the owner does not turn up, it's not even likely.
Yes.
So it's quite okay to return the money, the Radhi Mazalim, to any poor Shia Muslims, whether that Shia Muslim is a Sayyid or a non-Sayyid. It makes no difference.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take another break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jahad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Sawid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Sawid, I asked you a question before the break regarding the illicit or illegitimately gained money given as a way of compensation, or rather madalim, as you mentioned, as a kind of charity to a needy Sayyid. But what if there is some money actually found on the streets, let me say, like in the lanes or streets? Does the same rule apply to that? I mean, like, is it permissible to give this found money to a needy Sayyid?
Yes. Lost and found money, right?
Yes.
Lost and found money to a needy Sayyid. You're right. Well, of course, the answer is also in the affirmative. I should say, yes, it is permissible to give it to a Sayyid. It is charity. Of course, generally speaking, people understand, people know that giving charity to sadaqah is not permissible. But when this charity is wajib, like zakat al-fitr, cannot be given to a poor Sayyid. And that is the zakat of a non-Sayyid, that the zakat al-fitr of a non-Sayyid cannot be given to a Sayyid. Mm-hmm. And also the zakat which non-Sayyid people, Shia Muslims, might give, they cannot give their zakat to a Sayyid, right?
Right.
But this kind of charity, according to His Eminence, it is okay in the first place to give this found property. It could be money to a Sayyid. His Eminence says that the precaution, it's not an obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
The precaution is to give it to a non-Sayyid person, charity. And this charity must be given on behalf of the owner. Assuming that the owner is Muslim, he has lost his property and he does not turn up. So we give that amount of money as charity on behalf of him, of the actual owner, to a Sayyid or a non-Sayyid. It's better to give it to a non-Sayyid.
But if you live in a non-Islamic country where the majority is supposed to be non-Muslim,
yes,
then
it doesn't make sense to give that money as charity on behalf of the non-Muslim owner.
Uh-huh.
They do not believe in such a thing. They are not Muslims. They do not.
That's the point.
Yeah, that's the point.
Okay. And of course, what should they do?
The thing is that the scholars, the religious authorities, have said that it's better to give it to a Muslim,
mm-hmm.
not even intending to eat as a charity, because the charity should be given on behalf of the owner.
I see.
So it should be given to a needy Shia Muslim. And if a person wants to pick it up for himself, it's also even pick up. When